Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 24th, 2015. Parliament votes to extend President Salva Kiir's mandate.
3 years are met in order to give time so that all of us get prepared and census are conducted, constituents are met, then we shall then conduct free and fair elections throughout the country.
And on this World TB Day, officials say they are working to eradicate the killer disease.
TB affected 9 million people in 2013, killed 1.5 million people, including 360,000 people living with HIV, and also 500,000 multi-drug-resistant TB cases emerged in the same year.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese lawmakers voted today to extend the tenures of President Salva Kiir, members of the parliament, and state governors. But as Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba, today's vote was not completely in line with what Mr. Kiir's cabinet called for around 5 weeks ago, namely that the mandate of elected officials be extended by 2 years.
National Assembly spokesman Thomas Wanikundu says the extraordinary session of the legislature was well attended and more than 270 members of parliament from both houses voted in favor of extending the terms of lawmakers and President Kiir.
The tenor of the office extended is 36 months, which is 3 years.
Kundu says lawmakers also voted to extend the term of the Constitutional Review Commission. He says the terms of state legislators will be automatically extended if President Kiir signs the bill into a law. Today's vote comes 5 weeks after Information Minister Michael Makuei announced that South Sudan's national elections, which were supposed to be held at the end of June, were being postponed and the president's and National Assembly's terms were being extended by 2 years. Kundu says lawmakers voted today to put off elections and extend the tenures of elected officials for even longer for several reasons. First of all, he says if elections are held at the end of June 2017...
That is a rainy season. As you know, the environment and the climate in South Sudan does not allow elections to be conducted during the rainy season.
Kundu notes that lawmakers' tenures are supposed to end next week and President Kiir's term is supposed to end on July 8th. Kundu says the plan now is to let lawmakers stay in office until the end of December 2017, after which they will go on the campaign trail for around 2 months. He says elections would be held in March or April 2018. Kundu says delaying elections by an extra year will give South Sudan the time it needs to hold the free, fair and well-organized elections.
These 3 years are met in order to give time so that all of us get prepared and census are conducted, constituents are met, then we shall then conduct free and fair elections throughout the country.
Extending the tenures of elected officials and delaying national elections is in line with a power-sharing proposal that was signed at the end of January by President Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar. That proposal was brokered by regional bloc IGAD. It calls, among other things, for elections to be delayed until around December 2017 and for national lawmakers and the president's terms to be extended by 30 months from July 9th of this year or until around January 2018. Kundu says the extension the lawmakers voted in favor of will be sent to President Kiir tomorrow for his signature. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Today is World TB Day and the World Health Organization is rolling out a new strategy to end the global tuberculosis epidemic. We have several reports for you on fighting TB, but we begin with Lisa Schlein in Geneva, who reports the World Health Organization is calling for global support to wipe out this ancient disease over the next 20 years.
Two previous strategies have cleared the way for this latest and most ambitious plan. WHO is convinced its current strategy, called NTB, has a good chance of working because of the success of the .TB treatment and the Stop TB strategies that were rolled out earlier this century. Tremendous progress has been made in the fight against TB in recent years. Between 2000 and 2013, an estimated 37 million lives have been saved through TB diagnosis and treatment. But the World Health Organization says much more needs to be done to combat this deadly disease. Director of the WHO Global TB Program, Mario Raviglione, says the End TB strategy represents a historic opportunity to wipe out an epidemic that has been the cause of death, illness, and suffering for millennia.
Let us remember that TB affected 9 million people in 2013. Killed 1.5 million people, including 360,000 people living with HIV, and also 500,000 multidrug-resistant TB cases emerged in the same year, causing, of course, alarm and concern everywhere in the world, as these are difficult cases to manage and have a very high case fatality rate.
Tuberculosis is a contagious airborne disease. It is the second leading cause of death from a single infectious agent after HIV. More than 95% of cases and deaths are in developing countries. Tuberculosis is curable and preventable, and WHO is counting on this fact to push forward its ambitious new strategy, which calls for a 95% reduction in TB deaths and a 90% reduction in cases of TB by 2035. A key milestone to be reached in the next 5 years is the elimination of catastrophic costs for TB patients and their families. Tuberculosis can bankrupt families due to the direct medical costs and the loss of income linked to the six-month period of treatment. WHO says medical costs and loss of income can be offset through the establishment of various financial protection schemes, including universal health coverage. The strategy calls for bold policies by governments to support TB programs and emphasizes the need for new tools, intensified research, and innovation. Dr. Raviglione tells VOA there is movement in this direction, with new diagnostics and drugs coming down the pipeline.
We need rapid, right, molecular possibly, and genetic-based drug susceptibility testing. That's what we're after. Something that is simple and can be done at the most peripheral place as quickly as possible. And we are not far from that technology to possibly become true.
WHO reports the global cure rate for multidrug-resistant TB is 48% compared to an 86% cure rate for normal TB. Dr. Raviglione says two new drugs have been approved, which have the potential to increase the cure rate for both multidrug and extensively drug-resistant TB. But he notes problems of access and availability of these drugs still must be worked out. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And official from the South Sudan's Ministry of Health have been taking part in sending educational messages about preventing the spread of tuberculosis. Countries like South Sudan desperately need more laboratories for diagnosis and medical staff training. VOA fellow Michael Atit reports public health officials and non-governmental organizations are doing their best under difficult conditions to fight the disease.
In developing nations with scarce resources, diagnosing and treating tuberculosis can be a significant challenge, but countries like South Sudan are even worse off. A more urgent need is how to address the widespread lack of education and awareness about tuberculosis. 29-year-old Mabir Philip, a resident of Muniki Payam in Juba, was interviewed recently while receiving a treatment at Juba Teaching Hospital. He says that when he was growing up, people in his community thought TB was something hereditary.
They feel isolated because they are being separated from in the community. So most of them feel isolated, most of them get discouraged, they don't feel they are humans again, they get indignified.
That type of inaccurate information is usually confronted during events such as today's World TB Day commemoration. International Health Days can allow public health officials to inform, diagnose, and even steer people toward treatment. South Sudan's battle with TB is daunting. The country's deputy manager of the National Tuberculosis Control Program, Joseph Low, says, according to WHO, there are about 14,000 confirmed TB cases at present. Low is concerned about how quickly South Sudan's caseload is growing.
Other countries may increase their cases by 2% or 1%, but in South Sudan, we've seen a tremendous increase in caseload per year. And this is not really compared to the number of facilities, for example, that are diagnosing TB.
This means that in a country with only 280 primary health centers, only about 30% of the population has basic, consistent access to diagnosis and treatment of tuberculosis. Law says over the last 5 years, South Sudan TB caseload has increased by about 18%. Stephen Macharia, the TB control director for MSH in South Sudan, says his organization also provides technical support by expanding laboratory facilities and training staff.
For every one patient who is not treated in a year, he can actually transmit the disease to almost 16 people in 1 year. So that means if you don't get that one case, the possibility of that one case spreading the disease further to another 16 people in the community is quite high. And I think that's where we are trying to expand services, have universal access so that people can access these services closer.
On this World TB Day, WHO is calling on governments, affected communities, civil society organizations, healthcare providers, and international partners to carefully examine their TB control policies to ensure that they are effective. But Law says officials may almost have to start from scratch.
TB was treated as a separate disease with the separate health centers that are treating TB. But the Ministry of Health has realized that this one is not sustainable and it's not effective. So what the new policy is emphasizing is the fact that every primary care center should be able to include TB diagnosis and treatment into its routine work.
In South Sudan, officials say Jonglei State has the lowest number of TB cases. The highest numbers are in Central Equatoria, Western and Northern Bahr Ghazal and Warabi states. James Swani, Director of Tuberculosis and Leprosy Control at the Central Equatoria State Ministry of Health, says tuberculosis treatment is manageable.
We give patients anti-TB drugs for 1 week. After doing all this health education, information, everything, and let him ask and you answer his question, then you give for 1 week. He goes home, he takes his treatment, he comes back, he takes another one for 1 week, especially in the initial phase.
Fortunately, there is a tangible proof that prompt diagnosis, treatment, and support can help win the fight against TB in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Washington.
This report was prepared by Jacob Achek in Juba. Meanwhile, researchers developing a new generation tuberculosis drug say they are getting good results with a combination treatment that promises to work faster and cheaper than current medicine. Health reporter Art Chims has details.
In the latest in a series of tests, the new tuberculosis treatment, called PAMZ, outperformed current drugs, clearing twice as much TB bacteria from patients' saliva.
So we're saying that within 2 months of treatment, that this treatment could potentially be twice as effective, which we thought was a groundbreaking finding.
Dr. Rodney Dawson of the University of Cape Town is the lead author of a paper reporting the results in the medical journal The Lancet. The study involved more than 200 patients, some with drug-resistant TB, and others who had more treatable forms of the disease. The new PAMZ treatment was effective in both groups and also safe, showing minimal side effects. Dawson said the new drug can also be used with HIV/AIDS patients.
Which is a big concern with the current medication because of problems with the HIV medications interacting with TB drugs.
Millions of tuberculosis patients are also infected with HIV. Dawson says the new drug will need to be taken for a much shorter period of time, 6 months or less, compared to as long as 2 years for the current treatment. That could make a big difference because many TB patients don't stick with the long treatment protocol. The final round of clinical trials for PAMZ is now underway. If all goes well, and it doesn't always go well, but if it does, the new treatment for tuberculosis should be available after that round ends about 3 years from now.
So hopefully before the end of this decade, we would see a new treatment.
The South African pulmonologist adds that the new drug would bring down the cost of treatment to just one-tenth of what current medications for multidrug-resistant TB cost. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a preliminary water agreement is reached between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan on the River Nile. That story is after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Do you think some people have difficulty keeping time?
I think for us, as we say, African, they don't used to keep time. So I don't know, maybe it's just in our mind, we are just a bit lazy or something. They don't give too much importance to what they are doing or why.
This is a common issue, particularly in Africa and in our region in general, because The point, the main problem I see here is the training we have. We are not used to this. It's like at the early age, you are not trained how to respect time, and it keeps on growing and being the culture to the whole population. So the most problem is how we are nurtured and how people are nurtured.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan have signed a preliminary deal yesterday in Khartoum on sharing water from River Nile, allowing Ethiopia to continue with its construction of a massive new dam. Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn said the $4 billion hydroelectric dam his country is building will not disrupt the flow of the Nile. Ethiopia began constructing the dam several years ago with the goal of producing power for itself and nearby countries. Egypt, which relies on the river for agriculture and drinking water, has feared the dam would decrease its water supply. Water issues in the region have flared for decades. Colonial treaties gave Egypt and Sudan the majority of the Nile's water. Ethiopian Minister of Water Aleyehum Tegenu yesterday told VOA's Horn of Africa service the countries agreed that water from the Nile is essential for all the three nations, both for human uses and development activities. He said it took officials from the three countries months to create a common ground for understanding that includes seven basic principles, including not causing significant harm to another country and resolving misunderstanding through peaceful means. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about East Coast Fever. It kills one cow every 30 seconds in Africa, causing $300 million in annual losses. But a new discovery could lead to an effective and much cheaper way to prevent the disease by pitting one form of parasite against another. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Philip Toy says East Coast Fever is a major burden for millions of poor people in Africa, whose existence depends on healthy cattle.
It's restricted to East, Central, and Southern Africa, and in those countries, it's the most important constraint to livestock productivity. It affects particularly the better breeds of cattle. It's a lethal disease. It can kill up to 90-95% of a susceptible herd, and death usually occurs in about 2 to 3 weeks.
Toy is a principal scientist at ILRI, the Nairobi-based International Livestock Research Institute. He says the parasitic disease is spread by ticks and has devastating consequences if not controlled.
The means of control at the moment, pesticides, just to reduce the tick burden, is expensive and it requires continual application. And of course, there's also environmental effects there.
Currently, cattle can be inoculated against East Coast Fever. It's been shown to reduce calf mortality in some areas from about 50% to less than 3%.
There is a vaccine available. which involves inoculating essentially the live parasite, but at the same time giving a long-acting antibiotic, which means the animal experiences the infection but not the disease to any great extent. But they do develop a very strong immunity to the disease. So it's a very effective vaccine. It's very safe when administered correctly, but it's complex to produce and it is expensive.
Toy explains just how complex the vaccine's manufacturing process is.
Experimental cattle are actually infected with the parasite. The ticks are applied to the cattle, and then the ticks are recovered, and they're ground up, and then they're stored in liquid nitrogen. So it takes about 100 cattle, 600,000 ticks, and also rabbits, which are used to mature the parasite before it's ground up. So those costs are quite expensive. And it can take up to 12 to 18 months to produce a batch, because once it's made, it then has to be tested to ascertain the potency of the vaccine.
A batch can range from 500,000 to 1,000,000 doses. Toy says the potential new prevention method is based on a study of co-infections done in Western Kenya.
Up until relatively recently, most research was done looking at microorganisms in isolation. So one would look at the effects of a particular bacterium or a particular virus or a particular parasite. But it's more latterly been recognized that that's actually not what happens in reality, that people and animals get several different microorganisms at the same time. What is the effect of having two, three, or four different microorganisms? What is the effect of one on the other? Does it make the consequences of that infection more deleterious, or is it beneficial?
They discovered that the coexistence of parasites in calves appears to be a good thing in the East Coast fever zone.
With regard to the most important pathogen out in that area, which was Tularemia parva, which causes East Coast fever, that if calves were infected at the same time as they got Tularemia parva with a related organism called Tularemia mutans or Tularemia vilifera, the so-called low pathogenic Tularemia, then the odds of their dying of East Coast fever were significantly reduced. And that's the basis of the paper which is being published.
The findings appear in the journal Science Advances. Toy was asked if he knows why the co-infection greatly reduces the chances of cattle dying of East Coast fever.
No, that's a key question. We don't know if it's helping to remove that infection, or is it simply decreasing the effects of the disease that's caused by the infection. But if we could discover that, then it may open up lots of possibilities as to how to control these diseases.
The next step could involve intentionally infecting calves with the less harmful parasites to determine if they can then resist East Coast fever. If so, it could lead to a cheaper, easier-to-make vaccine. Some speculate the findings could be applied to other parasitic diseases, including malaria. Two parasites cause malaria, but one, Plasmodium falciparum, is much more deadly than the other, Plasmodium vivax. A 1996 study suggests that people in the South Pacific who have a genetic mutation making them susceptible to the less deadly parasite may be protected against Plasmodium falciparum. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move back to Juba. The French medical charity MSF says a container filled with ammunition exploded near Tarjat in Unity State, killing seven civilians and injuring one another person on Friday. MSF says it is treating the survivors of the explosion at its hospital in Lair. For VOA News, Charlton Doki has the story from Juba.
MSF says the container full of unexploded ordnance was left behind after heavy fighting between government and rebel forces last year. It exploded in the village of Gayel near Tharjath in Unity State. Florian Westphal, general director for MSF in Germany, was visiting Unity State when the accident happened.
This past Friday, we had a boy who was brought to the hospital in Leer with a number of lacerations, so wounds, especially to the legs, but also to the upper body, and who had to be taken care of. The wounds had to be cleaned, etc. And it appears that he was hurt when a container sitting on bricks, which was contained bullets and other unexploded ammunition, exploded.
MSF identified the survivor as 14-year-old Kume Saad Kwony. Westphal says sources told him that Kwonyi was visiting relatives in the area and looking for some shade from South Sudan's scorching sun. He says he and his seven companions were standing next to the container full of unexploded ordnance. Westphal says the incident shows the reality of what's happening in South Sudan, that the conflict is taking its toll on innocent civilians who have nothing to do with the fighting.
It seems this container exploded because somebody had set a fire to the grass around in this area to prepare it for farming, while shortly afterwards the boy and seven companions of his, who were all killed, stood next to the container for the shade when it then exploded. This sounds like a pretty serious incident. The boy is the only surviving eyewitness, and he was not yet in a state to talk about it directly. But from the other reports we've had, this is what appears to have happened.
Westphal says, although MSF does not keep statistics on how many unexploded ordnance has been dropped across South Sudan during the ongoing conflict, it's clear that the problem is widespread.
The worst thing about this problem is that people are not necessarily aware of the threat it poses, and very often, especially children, may pick up objects because they think they are something to play with, and they don't realize that these objects can be very, very dangerous. This is what we've seen in many conflict-affected countries around the world, and obviously we hope that this will not turn out to be too big a problem in South Sudan.
According to the United Nations Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, the current conflict has left explosives in urban areas such as Bor, Malakal and Bentiu, as well as in rural agricultural and pastoral communities. UNMAS says, particularly in Unity State, the threat of an exploded ordnance has made some roads impassable. Five vehicles hit anti-tank landmines in 2014 on roads near Unity, on roads near Bentiu. According to the Information Management System for Mine Action Database, more than 700 sites suspected of having an exploded ordnance still require clearing over the next 5 years in South Sudan. The agency says in some urban areas and villages, unexploded ordnance, including mortars, rockets and hand grenades, remain in the ground. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
And that report by Charlton Doki from Juba brings us to the end of our show for today. We now leave you with the song Agamlong Agar by Akoi Jazz Band. We have been listening to the Akwe Jazz Band with the song Jam Long Agar. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.